This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the author of The Misquotable C.S. Lewis. On the show today, I'm featuring the third and final episode of keynote highlights from the 2018 Lewis and Friends Colloquium from Taylor University. Specifically, today's show features portions from the keynote talks by Crystal Hurd and Crystal Downing. However, before getting into those highlights, as I did with the other shows, I'm sharing comments from students who attended, but this time I'm also including comments from a few others who attended as well. So that's what you'll hear first, then I'll share about 10 minutes each of Crystal Hurd's and Crystal Downing's keynote addresses. The segment with the comments from participants is about 9 minutes, so the keynote highlights follow after them.
My name is Tori. I'm from Tribeca Nazarene University. I just finished my junior year, and I'm an English major and creative writing minor. The Inkling I enjoy reading the most is probably C.S. Lewis and George MacDonald. I'm definitely partial to C.S. Lewis just because of the effect that he has had on my life and my studies. And I have not read all of his works, but it is definitely, I definitely will as soon as possible. My expectations before coming here, I really didn't know what to expect. Honestly, I've never been to anything like this. I didn't know if, I kind of assumed that I would be seen as very inferior because I'm very young and this is my first time. And I was very nervous about that. But now that I'm actually here, I am amazed at the value that everybody places on everybody and the way that nobody's ideas are discounted because of age, because of experience, anything. We're all viewed as individual minds, and that's very, it's very encouraging. And all the people that I've talked to, people that I now look up to and now can happily call my mentors, they're just so encouraging, and they truly believe in us younger Inklings as being the future for what we're doing now. And that's really amazing and encouraging to see and to feel. A few highlights of the conference would probably be Crystal Hurd's keynote speech, because I like to think outside the box and I like to try to really read into and analyze things that a lot of people don't think of. And I really enjoyed the way that she went back into his family to she didn't necessarily just look at who C.S. Lewis is, but why he's like that. And that was really, really interesting to me. And then I just really have enjoyed talking with everybody and networking and being encouraged and meeting so many new people and making new connections, and just the encouragement and the overall belief that everybody has in each other. And I've loved just getting to be a part of that.
Parker from University of St. Andrews in the UK. I am a first-year PhD student at the School of English. I enjoy reading Dorothy L. Sayers the most right now. She's the one that I'm currently reading. My expectations before coming to Taylor were that I would hopefully meet a community of scholars that I could engage with, and of course these expectations were exceeded. It's been a fantastic time to meet everybody and get to know others who are researching similar things, but also incredibly diverse areas of scholarship, and to learn new things about the Inklings. And some highlights from the conference would be the banquet, and just getting to relax and enjoy fellowship with one another, especially at the reception where Joe Rickey started playing ukulele along with the Balrog band. That was a really special moment, along with getting to tour the campus. Taylor University's been a beautiful campus and a fantastic host. The people here have been absolutely fantastic.
Hi, my name's Richard James, and I'm a retired pastor since 2005. And I've been to these Taylor, C.S. Lewis, and Friends conferences since they started in 1997. And I've been blessed by every one that I've been to. And it was a result of my knowing and meeting Dr. David Neuhauser at a Christian music festival in the summer of 1997. He was sharing about they were starting this program, and I had an interest in it, and so I decided to come. Then it used to be in November. And in terms of my benefit from these, I tried to give and to share my thoughts and ideas, and that's a benefit in a way, but I always receive more than I give, and I always enjoyed meeting new people. And if there's someone in the C.S. Lewis or Inklings or associated colleagues of them, I've learned a lot about all of them, and each year it's a little different, and I think it's getting better and better each year. Now this year, two places that touched my life in a very personal way is one of the speakers was talking about the influence of C.S. Lewis's family on his life and on his writings. And they put up something about the God in the Dock of essay. And I had forgotten, you know, in the back of your mind, there C.S. Lewis's father was a solicitor. And he was, C.S. Lewis knew this so well about the details of his father's work. And while he had had a mixed relationship with him after his mom had died, lo and behold, there he was influencing his work. And the realization, you know, that happens in all of our lives. And we look back and see how important people have been to us. So it kind of touched my heart personally. The second thing was every year we have a banquet, have a guest speaker. And so they try to sometimes look into new things. And the one of the new co-directors of the Wade Center was speaking after dinner, and she talked about Dorothy Sayers and the role that that film played in her life. And it was almost, I think what touched me was the intensity of almost like a Sherlock Holmes fan herself, getting to the connections for all of these things that were going on in the talk. And I look forward to discovering more about Dorothy Sayers and how these things all affected her life, other than just her writings and her detective stories and even her Christian translations and other essays that she did. So that was these are at least two things and many, many more. So I encourage you to come if you have never come. If you have come, keep on coming.
My name is Alan Snyder. I'm a professor of history at Southeastern University in Lakeland, Florida. So coming all the way from Florida up here, it was well worth it to me. I've been to Taylor before because I used to teach here in Indiana in the same county at Indiana Wesleyan University full-time, and I also taught as an adjunct here at Taylor. So in a sense, it was kind of a coming back home in that sense. Benefiting this time from being at Taylor, meeting people. That's the key thing, as well as hearing what they have to say about Lewis and everyone else connected with Lewis. You make the contacts, and the contacts aren't just for personal, selfish purposes. They are because you want to expand your world. You want to meet more people who have the same interests that you do. So I would say for those who are considering coming to something like this, that's one of the key things right there. Feel like you can kind of jump right in, you can get to know people, and it really will benefit you. Highlights about what has happened here. I really enjoyed Crystal Downing's, what was it called, the banquet speech, when she talked about Dorothy Sayers, who, by the way, I also spoke about in one of the sessions in my presentation. And she connected Dorothy Sayers with cinema, which is something I had never thought of before. So it was enlightening. It was also something I think everybody in the whole room just kind of lit up about it, the way she presented it and made it come alive. Actually, everything is alive here, and that's what I would say is well worth seeing. So I definitely would encourage people to come if they can.
don't know that Lewis actually came from a really talented family. Very, very interesting bunch of people. So some of the things I wanted to cover today was how did they influence him? And there were a myriad of ways. Of course, there was a family of writers. Both grandfathers were writers. Hamilton, Grandfather Hamilton, who was a minister, wrote poetry, not good poetry, but it was, there it is. Yeah, he actually kept a diary of some of his travels, which is available in the Lewis papers as well. His mother was a writer, his father was a writer and a poet, and his brother, of course, was his first co-author for Boxen. Now, of course, you probably remember, if you've read some of Surprised by Joy, the endless books that were stacked multiple layers, which I also do that to my husband's great displeasure. don't you have enough? I don't have enough. So he had, and if you know this, C.S. Lewis had this very issue, right, in his office. When he passed away, Hooper was pulling books and books and books and books and books from his office. So many books, because like his father, he hoarded them. He had tons of them, and that was something that he had seen his father do when he grown up. And he mentions in Surprised by Joy, nothing was prohibited for me. I could pull anything off and read it. Of course, Boxen was co-written, the stories of Animal Land was co-written with Warney. And you can see that now. It's been published, and it's got illustrations, which are wonderful. And I'm going to come back to this, but Albert had a lot to do with Boxen as far as the topics involved. A lot of politics in Boxen for something written by an 8-year-old, which is something he was hearing over and over in his own home, because Albert was constantly talking about politics with his sons. He thought that if he started them young, they'd become interested in politics, and they both hated politics as adults. So that didn't work at all. But that isn't to say that Albert was very persuasive. He was. Also, one of the things that was mentioned in Surprised by Joy is the missing joint in the thumb, which Lewis says prohibited him from playing sports. I'm not a doctor, you know, but but you know, it was just very interesting. I think he felt, even from a young age, that writing was natural, it was gravitational, and I'm here to tell you that it's hereditary, it's genetic. And that's why it felt so natural. So let's talk for a couple of minutes about his parents. This is Flora Lewis. She was one of four children from Reverend Thomas Robert Hamilton and Mary Warren Hamilton. Mary Warren Hamilton was a very outspoken nationalist. Her son-in-law was a very outspoken home rule proponent. So there are letters in the Lewis papers where they have great political discussions. She sent him some pamphlets. Which he said thanks, but no thanks. She was born 18 May, 1862. I put something up on Facebook, because it was her birthday in heaven. Reverend Hamilton was a chaplain with the Royal Navy. He also spent 4 years in Italy. So Flora spent 4 years from ages 8 to 12 in Italy. And that sparked her first piece that she wrote that we have, which is coming up. Now, what was she as far as an academic? She was basically a trailblazer. One of the first women to graduate with a math BA from Queens. In 1881, she achieved first class honors in geometry and algebra and had a lower pass division in French. The letter home to her and to her parents, which is in the Lewis papers, states that she had an unusually high score, beating out multiple other people, men and women. In 1885, she goes back. Also, her brother was very good at math. In 1885, she had first-class honors in logic and second-class honors in mathematics, with a lower pass division in the theory of music. Something that Lewis hates, right? Church music, anyway. 1886, she achieved a BA And this is something that Warney stated. Florence, like her brother Augustus, was a brilliant mathematician, and had her youth been lived in the period of female emancipation, would almost certainly have taken a better degree. So the time in which she was born, and the time in which women were limited in opportunities, he states if she had been born 100 years later, would have had a totally different life because of the opportunities and her stellar intelligence could have put her much farther in life. But she did not like poetry at all, but loved novels. So here we have an unusually high score in math, something that C.S. Lewis was terrible at, as we know. But that's okay. She actually did, and I found evidence last year in the Lewis papers that she was tutoring her boys in math. And she wrote about that back to the headmaster that she had been working with Warney specifically in algebra. So she was doing all this. In addition, as I stated in the Women in Lewis chapter, she used to take them to the sea for many summers to escape the climate. But she also gave them an opportunity to view a different landscape and to envision and imagine. She taught them how to play chess. She took them on train rides. So many interesting things and experiences that they had with their mother, which were integral for both of them as far as imagination. And there's some talk that Narni, which is a village in Italy, may have been what inspired Narnia. It's a very good possibility. I believe Hooper gave a copy of a map to the people of Narni several years ago. So, very, very intelligent mother, right? We do have a few writings by her, not much. Miracle at Firenze, which is in the C.S. Lewis Chronicle, Volume 5, Number 1, was written when we think she was probably 11 or 12 years old. And it's basically a chronicle of a miracle that supposedly happened at a church. Written by a young girl, you can tell. Now, a little bit later, we have Old Mother Hubbard. We have a portion of that in Volume 1 of Collected Letters. You can look that up. I'm sure you drug that huge tome with you up here. I use them for... No, I'm kidding. I don't work out. I'm not even going to make that joke. Old Mother Hubbard was poking fun at one of the rector's helpers. And if you read it, it's basically taking the Old Mother Hubbard, song, or, the saying, and turning it into this fiery sermon about this poor dog who has no bone, and this dusty, empty, it was great. It's hilarious. And Warney suspects that she actually intended it for her own father, which is a possibility. He was quite a character. The Princess Rosetta, we have looked and looked and looked for that, but we cannot find it right now. But it was published in the Household Journal of London. And as I mentioned in Women in Lewis, again, I'm not going to reference it a ton. I want to keep moving here. But she Flora dated Albert's brother for 5 years. They dated. It didn't end well. They broke up, and... then Albert began to write letters to her, and she wrote letters back and said, "Thanks, but no thanks. I just want to be friends. I have no interest." And poor old Albert did not give up. Multiple letters. Finally, when he found out that she loved to write, and he loved to write, he decided to start talking to her about authors. And before you know it, they were starting to have discussions about authors, and then Albert asked, "Can I have a copy of your short story?" And Flora was thinking, "He's gonna hate this. This is, forget it." She sends it. He praises it, and voila! Within a few months, they're dating. Are you taking notes, eligible bachelors? But unfortunately, we don't have that. But Warney does suspect that it was Flora who influenced Albert to write because we do have some of that stuff. As far as imaginative influences, you've probably figured this out.
Again, that was a portion of Crystal Hurd's keynote talk. Crystal has had a variety of articles related to C.S. Lewis published and has contributed an essay in the Women in C.S. Lewis book. Up next is Crystal Downing, who is the co-director of the Wade Center. In this talk, she explores a rarely mentioned aspect of Dorothy Sayers.
And I think we need to be more intentional about bringing film into our conversation about the Oxford Christians, because these days, the only way people are assimilating narrative is through cinema. Let me give you some background then on my approach and what I've discovered about Dorothy Sayers. As most of you know, Sayers became famous for her detective fiction, 12 novels, 20-some stories, the majority of which star amateur sleuth Lord Peter Wimsey. And this image is probably the most accurate from BBC television. What you may not realize is that by her fourth novel, Sayers had already developed what she called the infanticidal intention of doing away with Peter by marrying him off. Not only was she getting tired of Lord Peter's insufferable breeziness, but she was increasingly annoyed by the puzzle-like detective genre, believing that its problem-solution structure not only impeded the imagination, but also had negative effects on life itself. The problems of existence are rarely solved through easy denouements. Instead, the wages of sin tend to reign supreme, surmounted, Sayers would argue, only by the cross. The wages of cinema, however, led Sayers to theorize what this means for one's vocation. And this is what ignited the integration of imagination, scholarship, and faith for her. Now, ironically, Sayers' interest in film has been misrepresented, if not entirely overlooked, by her biographers. The grand dame of Sayers' studies, the brilliant Barbara Reynolds, who has been here before me, and to whom I owe immeasurable thanks, nevertheless, left out of her four-volume 2,000 plus pages of published letters, almost every single letter that praises cinema, while including what feels to me like every single reference to Dante. Now, of course, Sayers' work on Dante is extremely important. It cemented her relationship with Lewis, who relished her translations of the Inferno and Purgatorio. Sayers became a superb Dante scholar in the last season of her life. So I recognize that Sayers most fully synthesized faith, scholarship, and imagination through her work on Dante. But I want to show you how cinema got her there. Admittedly, none of us see things as they really are. We see things as we are. We all look through the lens of our own interests. So whereas Barbara Reynolds assessed Sayers through a medieval Italian lens, I look through the lens of something first marketed the year Sayers was born, 1893, the kinetoscope, invented by William Dixon for the Edison Company. And as most of you know, there was a continuous loop of film. You turned a crank and could watch through the peephole. Also in 1893 was invented the first film studio in history called the Black Maria. And it was this shed with this retractable roof so that the sun could shine through for filming. But you notice in the drawing, it's on tracks. So the shed would be moved to follow the sun so you could maximize the sunlight. I then am turning Sayers scholarship to capture the light from a different angle. And I begin, as did cinema, with celluloid. Before the switch to acetate film in the 1950s, both photographic and movie film was made of the substance that allowed Sayers' parents to photograph their only child numerous times. And here is one of my favorite photographs. This is the 14-year-old Dorothy pretending to be Athos from The Three Musketeers. and this will become significant in a bit. She enjoyed posing in front of the camera, but she also was a photographer. She won a school-wide photography contest not long before going up to Oxford University. During her mid-20s, though extremely strapped for cash, she was still living off funding from her father. She expended both money and time to travel from Oxford to London to have her picture taken by a professional photographer, justifying the expenditure to her concerned mother with, well, Oxford is perfectly useless for photographs. Now, this is the photograph that was taken. And she chose to go to the Regent Street studio of a 25-year-old photographer named Dorothy Wilding, proclaiming Wilding to be an artist way before, decades before anybody else recognized Wilding as an artist. And what made Wilding famous was her photographs of the royal family. Any of you who have seen the Netflix fantastic series, The Crown, their visual style is based on Dorothy Wilding photographs. So this is the person that Sayers recognized for her work. So I became intrigued by this connection to two yet-to-be-famous Dorothys, both born in 1893, the year cinema was born, and I proceeded to read Dorothy Wilding's memoir, which unfortunately never mentioned Sayers, but it does make clear that hanging on the wall of her Regent Street studio when Sayers went up to have her photograph taken was an image of Basil Rathbone, whom Wilding had posed, and this is straight from her memoir, in top hat, cape, and monocle, but he looked very similar to the way Sayers would present Lord Peter Wimsey in her first novel several years later. And coincidentally, or maybe not coincidentally, Basil Rathbone, as many of you know, became famous for portraying Sherlock Holmes in 14 films. And of course, Sayers mentions Sherlock Holmes, throughout her detective fiction, including her first novel. And her first novel, more than any other novel, is punctuated with references to photography and explicit references to camera work. So, photography fed Sayers' imagination, even more so, I suggest, when the images moved. In an unfinished memoir, Sayers mentioned seeing a magic lantern show, an often acknowledged antecedent of cinema. It was kind of like a slide projector, but some of you don't even know what a slide projector was. But these images would move. And Sayers describes going to a children's birthday party where the host projected a picture of a clown falling off a donkey. And Sayers recounts, I was frightened and had to be ignominiously taken out of the room. But then she qualifies her fright in the exact same paragraph by saying, I always had a robust taste for literary horrors, pleading for the most murderous tales of ogres. In other words, she found projected moving images more psychologically powerful than spoken or written terrors. And this will explain much to come in my talk. Sayers abandoned that memoir only a month after beginning it, only to include some of the incidents, but including this magic lantern incident in a fictionalized biography called Cat O'Mary, which includes another antecedent of cinema, the zoetrope. And this image appears in almost every film history book you could buy. And Sayers describes it as well as any film scholar ever has. Quote, it was like a great metal bowl with slits in the dial. You put in a sheet of colored papers around the inside and gave the bowl a twirl on its stem. And then when the bowl revolved, you looked through the slits and saw the pictures moving. It should not surprise us then that during her years at Oxford University, 1912 to 1915, Sayers took advantage of the town's six cinemas. It already had six cinemas by 1912. And she regaled her parents with what she saw on the screen, the Italian Quo Vadis, which scholars consider the first film epic, and also the French Three Musketeers. And I'm sure that she was especially interested in the character of Athos.
Again, you've been listening to the third and final podcast featuring highlights from the keynote addresses given at the 2018 Lewis and Friends Colloquium at Taylor University. Today's show had Crystal Hurd and Crystal Downing in the spotlight. If you haven't already heard the other two shows with four other excerpts, then check the show notes for a direct link to them. You can also learn about other shows related to this colloquium in those notes. You can get those show notes at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. Alternatively, you could go to where the audio files are hosted at allaboutjack.podbean.com. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. And in case you didn't know, you can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes. If you don't know how to do that, the show notes will help you to get to there because it has a direct link. Finally, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host for All About Jack. In addition to my new book for 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis, I have an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters that is entitled C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell.